practice in Germany or Canada or America. Yet he chose to be there, with his own people, for a fraction of the reward. He was one of thousands of health professionals working in the city, with careers as distinguished in what they denied themselves as in what they achieved every working day. And what they achieved was no less than the survival of the city. When Abdullah took us into the plattered traffic once more, his bike weaving a haphazard progress through the threads of buses, cars, trucks, bicycles, bullock wagons and pedestrians, he called over his shoulder to tell me that Dr. Hamid had once lived in a slum himself. He said that Kadabai had taken especially gifted slum children from several slums throughout the city and paid for their enrolment in private colleges. Through secondary and then tertiary studies, the children were provided for and encouraged. They graduated to become physicians, surgeons, nurses, teachers, lawyers, and engineers. Hamid was one of those gifted children who'd been selected more than 20 years before. In response to the needs of my small clinic, Kadirbai was calling in some dues.
"Kadirbai is a man who makes the future," Abdullah concluded, as we stopped for a traffic signal. "Most of us, me and you, my brother, we wait for the future to come to us. But Abdelkader Khan dreams the future, and then he plans it, and then he makes it happen. That is the difference between him and the rest of us. What about you, Abdullah?" I asked him in a shout as we roared off with the traffic once more. "Did Kadabai plan you?" He laughed out loud, his chest heaving with the pleasure and the force of the laugh.
"I think he did," he replied.
"Hey, this isn't the way back to the slum. Where are we going now?"
"We are going to visit the place where you will be getting your medicines."
"My what?"
"Kadabai has arranged for you to get medicines every week. The things I brought you today, those are the first. We are going to the medicine black market."
"A black market for medicine? Where is it?"
"In the slum of the lepers," Abdullah answered, matter-of-factly.
Then he laughed again as he pushed the bike to greater speed through a gap in the traffic that opened for him even as he reached it.
"Just leave it to me, Lin brother. Now you are part of the plan, isn't it so?"
Those words, "now you are part of the plan," should have woken some fear in me. I should have sensed something, even then, right at the start. But I wasn't afraid. I was almost happy. The words seemed exciting. They rushed my blood. When my fugitive life began, I was exiled from my family, homeland, and culture. I thought that was the whole of it. Years into the banishment, I realized that I was exiled to something as well. What I escaped to was the lonely, reckless freedom of the outcast. Like outcasts everywhere, I courted danger, because danger was one of the few things strong enough to help me forget what I'd lost. And staring into the warmth of the afternoon wind, riding with Abdullah into the web of streets, I fell as fearlessly into my fate that afternoon as a man falls into love with a shy woman's best smile. The journey to the lepers' camp took us to the outskirts of the city. There were several treatment colonies for Bombay's lepers, but the men and women we went to see refused to live in them. Funded by state and private contributions, the colonies provided medical attention, caring support, and clean environments. The rules and regulations that governed them were strict, however, and not all the lepers could bring themselves to conform. As a result, some chose to leave and some were forced out. At any one time, a few dozen men, women and children lived outside the colonies, in the wider community of the city. The elastic tolerance of the slum dwellers, who accommodated every caste and race and condition of person within their sprawl of huts, rarely extended to lepers. Local councils and street committees didn't endure their presence for long. Feared and shunned, the lepers formed themselves into mobile slums that settled within an hour in any open space they could find and made a traceless departure in even less time. Sometimes they established themselves for several weeks beside a rubbish dump, fending off the permanent ragpickers who resisted their incursion. At other times, they set up their camp on a swampy patch of vacant land, or some outfall for industrial waste. When I first visited them with Abdullah that day, I found that they'd built their ragged shelters on the rusty stones of a railway siding near the suburb of Kar. We were forced to park Abdullah's bike and enter the railway land as the lepers did, through gaps in fences and across ditches. The rusty plateau was a staging area for most trains on the urban route, and many of the goods wagons carrying produce and manufactured articles out of the city. Beyond the substation itself were office outbuildings, storage warehouses, and maintenance sheds. Further on was a vast shunting area, an open space marked by dozens of railway lines and their confluences. At the outer edges, high wire fences enclosed the space. Outside was the commerce and coziness of suburban Kar, traffic and gardens, balconies and bazaars. Within was the aridity of function and systems. There were no plants, no animals, and no people. Even the rolling stock were ghost trains, trundling from shunting stop to shunting stop without staff or passengers. Then there was the lepers' slum. They'd seized a diamond of clear space between the tracks for themselves and patched their shelters together in it. None of the huts was taller than my chest. From a distance, they looked like the pup tents of an army bivouac wreathed in the smoke of cooking fires. As we neared them, however, we saw that their appalling raggedness made the slum huts where I lived seem like solid, comfortable structures. They were made from scraps of cardboard and plastic, held aloft with crooked branches and braced with thin string. I could have knocked the whole camp to rubble with an open hand, and it would have taken me less than a minute. Yet 30 men, women and children made their lives there. We entered the slum unchallenged and made our way to one of the huts near the centre. People stopped and stared at us, but no one spoke. It was hard not to look at them, and then hard not to stare when I did look. Some of the people had no noses. Most of them had no fingers. The feet of many were bound in bloody bandages, and some were so advanced into the deteriorations that their lips and ears were missing. I don't know why. The price perhaps that women pay for their loveliness, but the disfigurement seemed more ghastly for the women than they were for the men. Many of the men had a defiant and even a jaunty air about them, a kind of pugnacious ugliness that was fascinating in itself. But shyness just looked cowed in the women, and hunger looked predatory. The disease was indiscernible in the many children I saw. They looked fit, if uniformly thin, and quite well, and they worked hard, all of those children. Their small fingers did the grasping for the whole of their tribe. They'd seen us coming and must have passed the word, because as we approached the hut, a man crawled out and stood to greet us. Two children came at once and supported him. He was tiny, reaching to just above my waist, and severely stricken with the disease. His lips and the lower part of his face were eaten away to a hard, knobby ridge of dark flesh that extended downwards from the cheeks to the hinges of his jaw. The jaw itself was exposed, as were the teeth and gums, and the gaping holes where his nose had been.
"Abdullah, my son," he said in Hindi. "How are you? Have you eaten?"
"I am well, Ranjit Bhai," Abdullah replied in respectful tones. "I have brought the gora to meet you. We have just now eaten, but we will drink tea. Thank you."
Children brought stools to us, and we sat there in the open space in front of Ranjit's hut. A small crowd gathered and sat on the ground or stood around us.
"This is Ranjit Bhai," Abdullah told me, in Hindi, speaking loudly enough for all to hear. "He is the boss here, the senior fellow in the slum of the lepers. He is the king here, in this club for colour topis."
Kala topi means black hat in Hindi, and it's a phrase used sometimes to describe a thief, referring to the black banded hats that convicted thieves were forced to wear in Bombay's Arthur Road prison. I wasn't sure exactly what Abdullah had meant by the remark, but Ranjit and the other lepers took it well enough, smiling and repeating the phrase several times. "Greetings, Ranjit Bhai," I said in Hindi. "My name is Lin."
"Ap doctor hai?" he asked.
"You are a doctor?" "No," I almost shouted in panic, disconcerted by the disease and my ignorance of it, and afraid he would ask me to help them. I turned to Abdullah and switched to English. "Tell him I'm not a doctor, Abdullah. Tell him I just do a little first aid and treat rat bites and scratches caused by the barbed wire and things like that. Explain to him. Tell him that I haven't had any real training and I don't know the first thing about leprosy." Abdullah nodded and then faced Ranjit Bhai.
"Yes," he said. "He's a doctor."
"Thank you very much, Abdullah," I gnashed out through clenched teeth. Children brought full glasses of water for us, and tea in chipped cups. Abdullah drank his water in quick gulps. Ranjit tilted his head back, and one of the children tipped the water in a gurgle down his throat. I hesitated, fearful of the grotesque sickness around me. One of the slum words in Hindi for lepers can be translated as the undead, and I felt that I was holding the nightmares of the undead in my hands. All the world of suffering disease was concentrated in that glass of water, it seemed to me. But Abdullah had drunk his glass. I was sure he'd calculated the risks and decided it was safe. And every day of my life was a risk. Every hour had its hazards, after the big gamble of escape from prison. The voluptuous recklessness of a fugitive moved my arm to my mouth, and I drank the water down. 40 pairs of eyes watched me drink. Ranjit's own eyes were honey-coloured and clouded by what I judged to be incipient cataracts. He examined me closely, those eyes roving from my feet to my hair and back, several times, with unshy curiosity.
"Kader Bhai has told me that you need medicines," he said slowly, in English.
His teeth clicked together as he spoke, and with no lips to help him form the words, his speech was difficult to understand. The letters B, F, P, and V were impossible, for example, with M and W coming out as other sounds altogether. The mouth forms more than just words, of course. It forms attitudes and moods and nuances of meaning, and those expressive hints were also missing. And he had no fingers, so even that aid to communication was denied him. Instead, there was a child, perhaps his son, who stood at his shoulder and repeated his words in a quiet but steady voice, one beat behind the rhythm of his speech, just as a translator might.
"We are always happy to help Lord Abdel Kader," the two voices said. "I have the honor to serve him. We can give you much medicine every week, no problem. First-class stuff, as you see."
He shouted a name then, and a tall boy in his early teens pushed through the crowd to lay a canvas bundle at my feet. He knelt to roll out the canvas and revealed a collection of ampoules and plastic bottles. There was morphine hydrochloride, penicillin, and antibiotics for staph and strep infections. The containers were labelled and new. "Where do they get this stuff?" I asked Abdullah, as I examined the medicines.
"They steal it," he answered me in Hindi.
"Steal it? How do they steal it?"
"Bahut hoshiyar," he replied.
"Very cleverly."
"Yes, yes."
A chorus of voices surrounded us. There was no humour in that concord. They accepted Abdullah's praise solemnly, as if he was admiring some work of art they'd collectively produced. "Good thieves, clever thieves," I heard people mutter around me. "What do they do with it?"
They sell it on the black market, he told me, still speaking in Hindi, so that all those present could follow our conversation. They survive nicely from this, and other very good stealing.
I don't get it. Why would anyone buy medicine from them? You can buy this stuff from just about any chemist.
You want to know everything, Brother Lin, isn't it? Well then, we must have another cup of tea, because this is a 2 cups of tea story.
The crowd laughed at that and pressed a little closer, picking out places to sit near us for the story. A large, empty, unattended goods wagon rumbled past slowly on an adjacent track, perilously close to the hut. No one gave it more than a cursory glance. A railway worker, dressed in khaki shirt and shorts, strolled between the lines inspecting the rails. He looked up at the lepers' camp from time to time, but his mild curiosity faded as he passed us, and he never looked back. Our tea arrived and we sipped it as Abdullah began his story. Several of the children were sitting against our legs, their arms wrapped around one another companionably. One little girl slipped her arm around my right leg and hugged me with artless affection. Abdullah spoke in very simple Hindi, repeating some passages in English when he perceived that I hadn't understood. He began by talking of the British Raj, the time when Europeans controlled all of India, from the Khyber Pass to the Bay of Bengal. The Firangi, the foreigners, he said, gave lepers the lowest priority on their scale of privileges and entitlements. As the last in line, lepers often missed out on the limited supply of medicines, bandages, and medical treatment. When famine or flood struck, even the traditional medicines and herbal remedies were in short supply. The lepers became skilled at stealing what they couldn't obtain by other means. So skilled, in fact, that they accumulated surpluses and began to sell medicines in their own black market. In India's vastness, Abdullah went on, there were always conflicts. Brigandage, rebellions, wars. Men fought and blood was spilled. But many more men died through the festering of wounds and the ravages of disease than were killed in battles. One of the best sources of intelligence available to police forces and governments lay in the control of medicines, bandages and expertise. All sales from chemists, hospital pharmacies, and pharmaceutical wholesalers were registered. Any purchase or string of purchases significantly greater than the established norm attracted attention that sometimes led to captures or killings. A telltale trail of medicines, particularly of antibiotics, had led to the downfall of many dacoits and revolutionaries. In their black market, however, the lepers asked no questions and sold to anyone who could pay. Their networks and secret markets existed in every great city in India. Their customers were terrorists, infiltrators, separatists, or just more than usually ambitious outlaws.
These people are dying, Abdullah concluded, with the colourful turn of phrase that I was learning to expect from him. And they steal life for themselves. And then they sell life to others who are dying.
When Abdullah finished speaking, there was a dense and ponderous silence. Everyone looked at me. They seemed to want some response, some reaction, to the story of their sadness and skill, their cruel isolation and violent indispensability. Whistling hisses of breath came through the clenched teeth of lipless mouths. Patient, serious eyes fixed me with expectant concentration.
Can I have another glass of water, please? I asked in Hindi. And it must have been the right thing to say, because the whole crowd started laughing.
Several children rushed off to fetch the water, and a number of hands patted me on the back and shoulder. Ranjit Bhai explained then how Sunil, the boy who'd showed us the canvas bundle of medicines, would make deliveries to my hut in the slum as and when I required them. Before we could leave, he asked that I remain seated for a while longer. Then he directed every man, woman, and child in his group to come forward and touch my feet. It was mortifying, a torment, and I entreated him not to do it. He insisted. A stern, almost severe expression burned in his eyes.
while the lepers hobbled forward, one by one, and tapped their leathery stumps or the blackened curled claws of their fingernails to my feet. An hour later, Abdullah parked his bike near the World Trade Center. We stood together for a moment, and then he reached out impulsively and enclosed me in a warm, bearish hug. I laughed as we came apart, and he frowned at me, clearly puzzled.
"Is it funny?" he asked.
"No," I reassured him. "I just wasn't expecting a bear hug, that's all."
"Bear? Do you mean it is naked?"
"No, no, we call that a bear hug," I explained, gesturing with my hands as if they were claws. "Bears, you know, the furry animals that eat honey and sleep in caves. When you hold someone like that, we say you're giving them a bear hug."
"Caves? Sleeping in caves?"
"It's okay, don't worry about it. I liked it. It was good friendship. It was what friends do in my country, giving a bear hug like that."
"My brother," he said with an easy smile, "I will see you tomorrow with Sunil from the lepers with new medicine."
He rode off, and I walked alone into the slum. I looked around me, and that place I'd once regarded as grievously forlorn seemed sturdy, vital, a miniature city of boundless hope and possibility. The people, as I passed them, were robust and invigorated. I sat down in my hut, with the thin plywood door closed, and I cried. Suffering, Kader Bhai once told me, is the way we test our love, especially our love for God. I didn't know God, as he'd put it, but even as a disbeliever, I failed the test that day. I couldn't love God, anyone's God, and I couldn't forgive God. The tears stopped after a few minutes, but it was the first time I'd cried for too long, and I was still deep in the mud of it when Prabhakar came into my hut and squatted down beside me.
"He's a danger man, Lin," he said without preamble.
"What?"
"This Abdullah fellow, who came here today, he is a very danger man. You are better not for any knowing of him, and doings with him are even worsely dangerous also."
"What are you talking about?"
"He is..."
Prabhakar paused, and the struggle was explicit in his gentle, open face.
"He is a killing man, Lin, a murdering fellow. He is killing the people for money. He is a gunda, a gangster fellow, for Kader Bhai. Everybody knows this, everybody, except of you."
I knew it was true, without asking any more, without a shred of proof beyond Prabhakar's word. "It's true," I said in my mind. In saying it, I realized that I'd always known or suspected it. It was in the way other people treated him, the whispers he inspired, and the fear I'd seen in so many of the eyes that looked into his. It was in the ways that Abdullah was like the best and most dangerous men I'd known in prison. That or something like that had to be true. I tried to think clearly about what he was and what he did, and what my relationship to him should or shouldn't be. Kader Bhai was right, of course. Abdullah and I were very much alike. We were men of violence, when violence was required, and we weren't afraid to break the law. We were both outlaws. We were both alone in the world. And Abdullah, like me, was ready to die for any reason that seemed good enough on the day. But I'd never killed anyone. In that, we were different men. Still, I liked him. I thought of that afternoon at the lepers' slum, and I recalled how self-assured I'd been there with Abdullah. I knew that a part of whatever equanimity I'd managed to display, perhaps most of it, had really been his. With him, I'd been strong and able to cope. He was the first man I'd met, since the escape from prison, who'd had that effect on me. He was the kind of man that tough criminals call a 100%er. The kind of man who'll put his life on the line if he calls you his friend. The kind who'll put his shoulder beside yours
without question or complaint, and stand with you against any odds. Because men like that are so often the heroes in films and books, we forget how rare they are in the real world. But I knew. It was one of the things that prison taught me. Prison pulls the masks away from men. You can't hide what you are in prison. You can't pretend to be tough. You are or you're not, and everyone knows it. And when the knives came out against me, as they did more than once, and it was kill or be killed, I learned that only one man in hundreds will stand with you, to the end, in friendship's name. Prison also taught me how to recognize those rare men when I met them. I knew that Abdullah was such a man. In my hunted exile, biting back the fear, ready to fight and die every haunted day, the strength and wildness and will that I found in him were more and better than all the truth and goodness in the world. And sitting there in my hut, striped with hot white light and cooling shadows, I pledged myself to him as brother and friend, no matter what he'd done, and no matter what he was. I looked up into Prabhakar's worried face and smiled. He smiled back at me, reflexively. And in an instant of unusual clarity, I saw that, for him, I was the one who inspired something of that confidence. As Abdullah was to me, so was I to Prabhakar. Friendship is also a kind of medicine. And the markets for it, too, are sometimes black. "Don't worry," I said, reaching out to put a hand on his shoulder. "It'll be all right. It'll be fine. Nothing's going to happen to me." Chapter 11. The long days, working in the slum and grinding commissions from the hard, jewelled eyes of tourists, unfolded one upon another through the tumble of crowded hours like lotus petals in a summer dawn. There was always a little money, and sometimes a lot of it. On one afternoon, a few weeks after that first visit to the lepers, I fell in with a party of Italian tourists who planned to sell drugs to other tourists at some of the bigger dance parties in Goa. With my help, they bought 4 kilos of charas and 2,000 mandrax tablets. I liked doing illegal business with Italians. They were single-minded and systematic in the pursuit of their pleasures, and stylish in the practice of their business. They were also generous, for the most part, believing in a fair minute's pay for a fair minute's work. The commission on that deal gave me enough money to retire for a few weeks. The slum absorbed my days, and most of my nights. It was late April then, only a little more than a month before the monsoon. The slum dwellers were busy making preparations for the coming of the rain. There was a quiet urgency in the work. We all knew what troubles the darkening sky would bring. Yet there was happiness in every lane and excitement in the easy smiles of the young ones, because after the hot, dry months, all of us were hungry for clouds. Kasim Ali Hussein appointed Prabhakar and Johnny Sagar as the leaders of 2 teams who were responsible for helping widows, orphans, disabled people, and abandoned wives to repair their huts. Prabhakar won the assistance of a few willing lads to gather bamboo poles and small lengths of timber from the piles of scrap at the construction site beside our slum. Johnny Sagar chose to organise several street kids into a marauding band of pirates who plundered the neighbourhood for pieces of tin, canvas and plastic. All manner of things that might be used as weatherproofing materials began to vanish from the vicinity of the slum. One notable expedition by the tiny pilferers produced a huge tarpaulin that from its shape had clearly been the camouflage cover for a battle tank. That piece of military software was cut into 9 pieces and used to protect as many huts. I joined a team of young men who'd been given the task of clearing the drains and gullies of snarls and snags. Months of neglect had filled those places with an accumulation of cans and plastic bottles and jars. Everything that rats wouldn't eat and that scavengers hadn't found. It was dirty work, and I was glad to do it. It took me to every corner of the slum and introduced me to hundreds of people I might otherwise never have known.
and there was a certain kudos in the job. Humble and important tasks were as esteemed in the slum as they were reviled in the wider community. All the teams who worked to defend the huts from the coming rain were rewarded with love. We only had to lift our heads from the filthy drains to find ourselves in a luxuriant garden of smiles. As head man in the slum, Kasim Ali Hussein was involved in every plan and decision in those preparations. His authority was clear and unquestioned, but it was a subtle, unobtrusive leadership. An incident that occurred in those weeks before the rain brought me into the ambit of his wisdom and revealed to me why it was so widely revered. A group of us had gathered in Kasim Ali's hut one afternoon to hear his eldest son tell stories of his adventures in Kuwait. Iqbal, a tall, muscular 24-year-old with an honest stare and a shy smile, had recently returned after 6 months of work as a contract labourer in Kuwait. Many of the young men were eager to gain from his experience. What were the best jobs? Who were the best masters? Who were the worst ones? How did you make extra money between the flourishing black markets of the Gulf States and those of Bombay? Iqbal held impromptu classes every afternoon for a week in the main room of his father's hut, and the crowd spilled out into the forecourt to share in his precious knowledge. On that day, however, his discourses were interrupted abruptly by shouts and screaming. We rushed out of the hut and ran towards the sound. Not far away, we discovered a noisy mob of men, women, and children. We pushed our way to the centre, where two young men were wrestling and punching at one another. Their names were Farooq and Raghuram. They were from the team that was helping Prabhakar to gather poles and lengths of wood. Iqbal and Johnny Sagar separated the combatants, and Kasim Ali stepped between them, his presence quieting the raucous crowd at once.
"What is happening here?"
he asked, his voice unusually stern.
"Why are you fighting?"
"The Prophet! May Allah grant him peace!" Farooq shouted. "He insulted the Prophet!"
"And he insulted the Lord Ram,"
Raghuram countered. The crowd supported one or the other with shrieks and condemnations. Kasim Ali gave them half a minute of noise, then raised his hands for silence.
"Farooq, Raghuram, you two are friends, good friends," he said. "You know that fighting is no way to settle your differences. And you both know that fighting between friends and neighbors is the worst fighting of all."
"But the Prophet, peace be upon him, Raghu insulted the Prophet. I had to fight with him,"
Farooq whined. He was still angry, but Kasim Ali's hard stare was causing him to wilt, and he couldn't meet the older man's eye.
"And what of insulting the Lord Ram?" Raghuram protested. "Isn't that also a reason to—" "There is no excuse,"
Kasim Ali thundered, silencing every voice.
"There is no reason that is good enough to make us fight with each other. We are all poor men here. There are enemies enough for all of us outside this place. We live together or we die. You two young fools have hurt your people, your own people. You have hurt all of our people of every faith. And you have shamed me terribly."
The crowd had grown to more than 100 people. Kasim's words caused a stir of rumbling comments that rippled through them as heads touched together. Those closest to him, at the centre, repeated what he'd said, relaying the message to others at the edges of the group. Farooq and Raghuram hung their heads wretchedly. Kasim Ali's charge that they'd shamed him rather than themselves was a telling blow.
"You must both be punished for this," Kasim said,
a little more gently, when the crowd was quieter.
"Your parents and I will choose a punishment for you tonight. Until then, you will work for the rest of the day at cleaning the area around the latrine."
New murmurs buzzed through the crowd. Conflicts based on religion were potentially dangerous, and people were glad to see that Kasim took the matter seriously. Many of the voices around me spoke of the friendship between Farooq and Raghuram, and I realized that what Kasim had said was true.
the fighting between close friends of different faiths had hurt the community. Then Qasim Ali removed the long green scarf that he wore around his neck and held it aloft for all to see.
You will work in the latrine now. But first, Farooq and Raghuram, I will bind you together with this, my scarf. It will remind you that you are friends and brothers, while cleaning the latrine will fill your noses with the stink of what you have done to each other today.
He knelt then and tied the two young men together at the ankle, Farooq's right to Raghuram's left. When it was done, he stood and told them to go, pointing with outstretched arm in the direction of the latrine. The crowd parted for them, and the young men tried to walk, but they stumbled at first, and soon realized that they had to hold on tightly and walk in step if they were to make any progress at all. They clasped their arms around one another and hobbled away on three legs. The crowd watched them walk and began to chatter in praise of Qasim Ali's wisdom. Suddenly there was laughter, where a minute before there'd been tension and fear. People turned to speak to him, but discovered that Qasim was already walking back to his hut. I was close enough to him to see that he was smiling. I was lucky and shared that smile often in those months. Qasim visited my hut two and sometimes three times a week, checking on my progress with the increasing number of patients who came to me after Dr. Hamid began to accept my referrals. Occasionally, the headman brought someone with him, a child who'd been bitten by rats, or a young man who'd been injured at the construction site beside the slum. After a while, I realized that they were people he'd chosen to bring to me, personally, because for one reason or another they were reluctant to come alone. Some were simply shy. Some had resentments against foreigners and refused to trust them. Others were unwilling to try any form of medicine other than traditional village remedies. I had some trouble with the village remedies. In the main, I approved of them, and even adopted them wherever it was possible, preferring some of the Ayurvedic medicines to their Western pharmaceutical equivalents. Some treatments, however, seemed to be based on obscure superstitions rather than therapeutic traditions, and they were as contrary to common sense as they were to any notions of medical science. The practice of applying a coloured tourniquet of herbs to the upper arm as a cure for syphilis, for example, struck me as particularly counterproductive. Arthritis and rheumatism were sometimes treated by taking cherry red coals from the fire with metal tongs and holding them against the knees and elbows of the sufferer. Qasim Ali told me privately that he didn't approve of the more extreme remedies, but he didn't prohibit them. Instead, he visited me regularly, and because the people loved him, they followed his example and came to me in greater numbers. Qasim Ali's nut-brown skin, stretched over his lean and sinewy body, was as smooth and taut as a boxer's glove. His thick silver-grey hair was short, and he sported a goatee beard one shade lighter than his hair. He most often wore a cotton kurta and plain white Western-style trousers. Although they were simple, inexpensive clothes, they were always freshly washed and ironed, and he changed them twice every day. Another man, a less revered man with similar habits of dress, would have been considered something of a dandy. But Qasim Ali raised smiles of love and admiration wherever he went in the slum. His immaculately clean white clothes seemed to all of us a symbol of his spirituality and moral integrity, qualities we depended on in that little world of struggle and hope, no less urgently than we depended on the water from the communal well. His 55 years sat lightly on his taller-than-average frame. More than once, I watched him and his young son run from the water tanks to their hut with heavy containers of water hoisted onto their shoulders, and they were neck and neck all the way. When he sat down on the reed mats in the main room of his hut, he did so without touching his hands to the ground. He crossed his feet over and then lowered himself to a sitting position by bending his knees. He was a handsome man, and a great part of his beauty derived from the healthy vitality and natural grace that supported his inspirational and commanding wisdom. With his short, silver-grey hair, lean figure, and deeply resonant voice, Kasim reminded me often of Kader Bai. I learned sometime later that the two powerful men knew each other well and were in fact close friends. But there were considerable differences between them, and perhaps none more significant than the authority of their leadership and how they'd come by it. Kasim was given his power by a people who loved him. Kader Bai had seized his power and held it by strength of will and force of arms. And in the contrast of powers, it was the mafia lords that dominated. The people of the slum chose Kasim Ali as their leader and head man, but it was Kader Bai who'd approved the choice and who'd allowed it to happen. Kasim was called upon to exercise his power frequently because his was the only real day-to-day authority in the slum. He resolved those disputes that had escalated into conflict. He mediated claims and counterclaims concerning property and rights of access. And many people simply sought his advice about everything from employment to marriages. Kasim had three wives. His first wife, Fatima, was 2 years younger than he was. His second wife, Shaila, was younger by 10 years. His third wife, Najima, was only 28 years old. His first marriage had been for love. The two subsequent marriages were to poor widows who might not otherwise have found new husbands. The wives bore him 10 children between them, 4 sons and 6 daughters. And there were 5 other children who'd come to him with the widowed wives. To give the women financial independence, he bought 4 foot-treadle sewing machines for them. His first wife, Fatima, set the machines up under a canvas canopy outside the hut and hired 1, 2, 3, and eventually 4 male tailors to work at making shirts and trousers. The modest enterprise provided living wages for the tailors and their families, and a measure of profit, which was divided equally among the 3 wives. Kasim took no part in the running of the business, and he paid all the household expenses, so the money made by his wives was their own to spend or save as they wished. In time, the tailors bought slum huts around Kasim's own, and their wives and children lived side by side with Kasim's, making up a huge extended family of 34 persons who looked upon the head man as father and friend. It was a relaxed and contented household. There was no bickering or bad temper. The children played happily and did their chores willingly. And several times a week, he opened his large main room to the public as a majlis or forum, where the slum dwellers could air their grievances or make requests. Not all the disputes or problems in the slum were brought to Kasim Ali's house for a timely resolution, of course. And sometimes Kasim was forced to take on the roles of policeman and magistrate in that unofficial and self-regulating system. I was drinking tea in the foreground of his house one morning, some weeks after Abdullah took me to the lepers, when Jitendra rushed up to us with the news that a man was beating his wife, and it was feared that he might kill her. Kasim Ali, Jitendra, Anand, Prabhaka, and I walked quickly through the narrow lanes to a strip of huts that formed the perimeter of the slum at the line of mangrove swamp. A large crowd had gathered outside one of the huts, and as we neared it, we could hear a pitiable screaming and the smack of blows from within. Kasim Ali saw Johnny Cigar standing close to the hut and pushed his way through the silent crowd to join him.
"What's happening?" he demanded. "Joseph is drunk,"
Johnny replied sourly, spitting noisily in the direction of the hut.
"The Bahinchud has been bashing his wife all morning." "All morning? How long has this been going on?"
3 hours, maybe longer. I just got here myself. The others told me about it. That's why I sent for you, Kasim Bai."
Kasim Ali drew his brows together in a fierce frown and stared angrily into Johnny's eyes.
"This is not the first time that Joseph has beaten his wife. Why didn't you stop it?"
Johnny began, but he couldn't hold the stare, and he looked down at the stony ground at their feet. There was a kind of rage in him, and he looked close to tears.
"I'm not afraid of him. I'm not afraid of any man here. You know that. But she's his wife."
The slum dwellers lived in a dense, crowded proximity,
the most intimate sounds and movements of their lives entwined constantly, each with every other. And, like people everywhere, they were reluctant to interfere in what we usually call domestic disputes, even when those so-called disputes became violent. Kasim Ali reached out and put a compassionate hand on Johnny's shoulder to calm him, and commanded that he stop Joseph's violence at once. Just then, a new burst of shouting and blows came from the house, followed by a harrowing scream. Several of us stepped forward, determined to put a stop to the beating. Suddenly, the flimsy door of the hut crashed open, and Joseph's wife fell through the doorway and fainted at our feet. She was naked. Her long hair was wildly knotted and matted with blood. She'd been cruelly beaten with some kind of stick, and blue-red welts crossed and slashed her back, buttocks and legs. The crowd flinched and recoiled in horror. They were as affected by her nakedness, I knew, as they were by the terrible wounds on her body. I was affected by it myself. In those years, nakedness was like a secret religion in India. No one but the insane or the sacred was ever publicly naked. Friends in the slum told me with unaffected honesty that they'd been married for years and had never seen their own wives naked. We were all stricken with pity for Joseph's wife, and shame passed among us, burning our eyes. A shout came from the hut then, and Joseph stumbled through the doorway. His cotton pants were stained with urine, and his t-shirt was torn and filthy. Wild, stupid drunkenness twisted his features. His hair was disheveled, and blood stained his face. The bamboo stick he'd used to beat his wife was still in his hands. He squinted in the sunlight, and then his blurred gaze fell on his wife's body, lying face down between himself and the crowd. He cursed her and took a step forward, raising the stick to strike her again. The shock that had paralyzed us escaped in a collective gasp, and we rushed forward to stop him. Surprisingly, little Prabhakar was the first to reach Joseph, and he grappled with the much bigger man, pushing him backwards. The stick was wrenched from Joseph's hand, and he was held down on the ground. He thrashed and screamed, a string of violent curses spilling with the drool from his lips. A few women came forward, wailing as if in mourning. They covered Joseph's wife with a yellow silk sari, lifted her, and carried her away. The crowd might have become a lynch mob then, but Kasim Ali took charge of the scene immediately. He ordered the people to disperse or stand back, and he told the men who were holding Joseph to keep him pinned on the ground. His next command astonished me. I thought he might call for the police or have Joseph taken away. Instead, he asked what alcohol Joseph had been drinking and demanded that 2 bottles of it be brought to him. He also called for charas and a chillum and told Johnny Cigar to prepare a smoke. When the rough home-brewed alcohol, known as Daru, was produced, he instructed Prabhakar and Jitendra to force Joseph to drink. They sat Joseph in a circle of strong young men and offered him one of the bottles. He glared at them suspiciously for a few moments, but then snatched the bottle and took a long, greedy swig. The young men around him patted him on the back, encouraging him to drink more. He gulped down more of the extremely powerful Daru, and then tried to push it away, saying that he'd had enough. The young men became forceful in their coaxing. They laughed and joked with him, holding the bottle to his lips and driving it between his teeth. Johnny Cigar lit the chillum and passed it to Joseph. He smoked and drank and smoked again. Then, some 20 minutes after he'd first stumbled from the hut with the bloody stick in his hand, Joseph dipped his head and passed out cold on the rubble-strewn path. The crowd watched him snore for a while, and then they gradually drifted away to their huts and their jobs. Kasim told the group of young men to stay in their circle around Joseph's body and watch him closely. He left for about 30 minutes to perform the mid-morning prayer. When he returned, he ordered tea and water. Johnny Cigar, Anand, Rafiq, Prabhakar, and Jitendra were in the watchful circle. A strong young fisherman named Vijay was also in the group, and a lean, fit cart pusher known as Ankara, or Darkness. because of his luminously dark skin. They talked quietly while the sun rose to its zenith and the sweltering humidity of the day clamped a moist grip on us all. I would have left then, but Kasim Ali asked me to stay, so I sat down under the shade of a canvas veranda. Vijay's four-year-old daughter, Sunita, brought me a glass of water, without my asking for it. I sipped the lukewarm liquid gratefully. "Sangli Mulgi, Sangli Mulgi," I thanked her in Marathi. "Good girl, good girl." Sunita was delighted that she'd pleased me, and stared back at me with a furious little smiling frown. She wore a scarlet dress with the words, "My Cheeky Faces," printed in English across the front. I noticed that the dress was torn and too tight for her, and I made a mental note to buy some clothes for her and a few of the other kids in the cheap clothing bazaar known as Fashion Street. It was the same mental note I made every day, every time I talked to the clever, happy kids in the slum. She took the empty glass and skipped away, the metal bells of her ankle bracelets jingling their small music, and her tiny bare feet tough against the stones. When all the men had taken tea, Kasim Ali ordered them to wake Joseph. They began to prod and poke him roughly, shouting at him to wake up. He stirred and grumbled resentfully, waking very slowly. He opened his eyes and shook his groggy head, calling petulantly for water.
"Pani nahi," Kasim said.
"No water." They forced the second bottle on him, roughly insistent, but cajoling him with jokes and pats on the back. Another chillum was produced, and the young men smoked with him. He growled repeatedly for water. Every time he found the strong alcohol thrust into his mouth instead. Before a third of the bottle was finished, he fainted again, collapsing to the side with his head lolling at an awkward angle. His face was bare to the climbing sun. No one made any attempt to shade him. Kasim Ali allowed him a mere 5 minutes to doze before ordering that he be woken. Joseph's grumbling was angry as he woke, and he began to snarl and curse. He tried to raise himself to his knees and crawl back to his hut. Kasim Ali took the bloodied bamboo stick and handed it to Johnny Cigar. He spoke one word of command. "Begin." Johnny raised the stick and brought it down on Joseph's back with a resounding smack. Joseph howled and tried to crawl away, but the circle of young men pushed him back to the center of their group. Johnny struck him with the stick again. Joseph screamed angrily, but the young men slapped at him and shouted for silence. Johnny raised the stick, and Joseph cowered, trying to focus his bleary eyes.
"Do you know what you have done?"
Johnny demanded harshly. He brought the stick down with a whack on Joseph's shoulder.
"Speak, you drunken dog! Do you know what a terrible thing you have done?"
"Stop hitting me," Joseph snarled.
"Why are you doing this?"
"Do you know what you have done?"
Johnny repeated. The stick struck again.
"Oh, ah!"
Joseph shrieked.
"What? What have I done? I have done nothing."
Vijay took the stick and beat Joseph on the upper arm.
"You beat your wife, you drunken pig. You beat her, and maybe she will die."
He passed the stick to Jitendra, who used it to smack Joseph on the thigh.
"She's dying. You are a murderer. You murdered your own wife."
Joseph tried to shield himself with his arms, casting his eyes about feverishly for some escape. Jitendra lifted the stick again.
"You beat your wife all morning and threw her naked from the hut. Take that, you drunkard, and that, just as you beat her. How do you like it, you murderer?"
The slow creep of a foggy comprehension stiffened Joseph's face into a terrified anguish. Jitendra passed the stick to Prabhakar, and the next blow brought tears.
"Oh, no," he sobbed. "It's not true. I haven't done anything. Oh, what will happen to me? I didn't mean to kill her. God in heaven, what will happen to me? Give me water. I need water."
"No water,"
Kasim Ali said. The stick came down again and again. It was in Ankara's hand.
Worrying about yourself, dog? What about your poor wife? You didn't worry when you beat her. This is not the first time you took this stick to her, is it? Now it is finished. You killed her. You can never beat her again, not her or anyone. You will die in the jail.
Johnny Cigar took the stick again.
Such a big, strong fellow you are. So brave to beat your wife, who is half your size. Come on and beat me, hero. Come on, take this stick of yours and beat a man with it, you cheap gunda.
Water,
Joseph blubbered, collapsing to the ground in tears of self-pity.
No water, Kasim Ali said,
and Joseph drifted into unconsciousness once more. When they woke him the next time, Joseph had been in the sun for almost 2 hours, and his distress was great. He shouted for water, but they offered him only the Daru bottle. I could see that he wanted to refuse it, but his thirst was becoming desperate. He accepted the bottle with trembling hands. Just as the first drops touched his parched tongue, the stick came down again. Daru spilled over his stubbled chin and ran from his gaping mouth. He dropped the bottle. Johnny picked it up and poured the remaining alcohol over his head. Joseph shrieked and tried to scramble away on his hands and knees, but the circle of men wrestled him back to the center. Jitendra wielded the stick, smacking it onto his buttocks and legs. Joseph whined and wept and moaned. Kasim Ali was sitting to one side, in the shaded doorway of a hut. He called Prabhakar to him and gave orders that a number of Joseph's friends and relatives should be sent for, as well as relatives of Maria, Joseph's wife. As the people arrived, they took the places of the young men in the circle, and Joseph's torment continued. For several hours, his friends and relatives and neighbors took turns to vilify and accuse him, beating him with the stick he'd used to assault his wife so savagely. The blows were sharp, and they hurt him. But they weren't severe enough to break the skin. It was a measured punishment that was painful, but never vicious. I left the scene and returned a few times during the afternoon. Many of the slum dwellers who were passing that way stopped to watch. People joined the circle around Joseph, or left it, as they wished. Kasim Ali sat in the doorway of the hut, his back straight and his expression grave, never taking his eyes from the circle. He directed the punishment with a quiet word or a subtle gesture, keeping a relentless pressure on the man, but preventing any excesses. Joseph passed out twice more before he finally broke down. When the end came, he was crushed. All the spite and defiance in him were defeated. He sobbed the name of his wife over and over again. Maria. 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 Kasim Ali stood and approached the circle. It was the moment he'd waited for, and he nodded to Vijay, who brought a dish of warm water, soap, and two towels from a nearby hut. The same men who'd been beating Joseph cradled him in their arms then and washed his face, neck, hands, and feet. They gave him water. They combed his hair. They soothed him with hugs and the first kind words he'd heard since the beginning of his chastisement. They told him that if he were genuinely sorry, he would be forgiven and given help. Many people were brought forward, myself included, and Joseph was made to touch our feet. They dressed him in a clean shirt and propped him up, their arms and shoulders supporting him tenderly. Kasim Ali squatted close to him and stared into his bloodshot eyes.
"Your wife, Maria, is not dead," Kasim Ali said softly.
Not dead,
he mumbled.
No, Joseph, she is not dead. She is very badly injured, but she is alive.
Oh, thank God, thank God.
The women of your family and Maria's family have decided what is to be done,
Kasim said slowly, firmly.
Are you sorry? Do you know what you have done to your wife?
And are you sorry for it?
Yes, Kasimbai,
Joseph wept.